Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's call. We will begin the call with a quick roll call of all the facilities on board. Montefiore Medical, Wyckoff Heights, New York Presbyterian Hospital, New York Methodist, Franklin Hospital, NYU Medical, St. Charles Hospital, Long Island Jewish Hospital, Stanford Hospital, Peninsula Hospital, Staten Island University, Glen Cove Hospital, Franklin Hospital, Our Lady of Mercy Medical Center, Long Island College, St. Charles Hospital, Soundshore Medical, St. Catherine of Sion, Huntington, Plainview Hospital, Syosset Hospital, and Good Samaritan. You may begin your conference.
Excellent. Actually, operator, could you please put Our Lady of Mercy into the subconference?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hi, everybody. This is Rachel Block and Hillary Jalon. At the last minute, Terry Straub was called to a meeting in Washington, D.C. She is going to try to join us, but she wasn't 100% sure if and when she would do that. So Hillary and I are going to be driving the bus today, and I'm pleased to – it sounds like we have a good number of hospitals participating in the call, so – and I'm sure we'll have a couple of more folks coming on as we go on. Just to briefly cover what we're going to do today, we're going to spend some time doing some more sort of roundtable-type discussions on a few of what we have come to think of as the hot topics that we have gotten either the most comments or questions about from you. And we have joining us in the subconference several hospitals who have agreed to kick off those discussions. We're not going to do formal PowerPoints or anything like that. We're just going to have them tee us up with a few issues and observations. And then as we go through each topic, we will open it up for folks to do share their comments or ask questions. And we will then go through each topic separately as they're listed on your agenda. Then at the end, we'll do our usual sort of update and review of upcoming issues and also share with you and discuss briefly positive evaluation results that we got from the 10-19 session, but also talk about some of the additional comments that you've provided us on the evaluations, which were partly the basis of our how we organized today's call. So without further ado, since my colleague Hillary Jalon kind of got the topics of interest and the speakers organized for this section, I'm going to turn it over to Hillary.
Thanks, Rachel. Actually, it was great to talk. We've seen some great progress in the monthly reports that we get, and I just want to mention that there were some hospitals that had some struggles at the beginning, and now we're seeing some really positive results from those reports. And based on a survey that we sent out, some of you provided input that you wanted to see more of this roundtable type of format on the conference call. So we're going to see how we can do this and get some participation from those of you that aren't in the subconference. The topics on your agenda, there's five that were noted as real hot topics in this collaborative. The first is line maintenance. And we got Lutheran Medical Center and Mount Sinai Hospital both on the line to explain some of the things that they've done with line maintenance. So I'm going to have Grace Langan and Doctor, I'm going to ruin your name, Giaccio.
That's pretty good.
From Lutheran, just to explain a great program they have with regard to line maintenance.
Well, the problem is so far we've had a line infection each month for the last 4 months since we've started the collaborative. So we're narrowing it down to, you know, there's two places where the organisms can enter. One is at the puncture site, and the other is at the tips of the catheters where you have the end caps. So, you know, I'm toying with the idea. We haven't gone to biopatches yet, so we're looking to the Greater New York to tell us the hospitals that are using biopatches, how much have they knocked down their line infection rate. And then we're also looking at we use needleless end caps. And I can't see how these things are sterile after you use them one time. And especially if you do a blood draw from them. And even if you flush the line, there's going to be some blood in the space between plastic meeting plastic. That just seems to me like fertile ground for bacteria to grow. And the other thing is wrestling with the idea of trying to get people not to use the central line for blood draw and to try to still get to use a peripheral site for blood drawing. So those are the issues we're wrestling with. Really looking to the collaborative to tell us how much biopatches are getting it down. And we're at a disadvantage because we're not using biopatches. I just don't know how much of the line infections are coming from the needleless end cap use. I know Dr. Shannon, I picked his brain. He's not using needleless end caps. He's using simple end caps. They're much cheaper. And every time the line is touched, he throws them away and puts a new sterile end cap on. Our needleless end caps, I hear, costing anywhere from $1.25 to $1.50 each, and we change them every 3 days. So it's a very expensive line maintenance issue. And biopatches, I understand, we can go to once a week changing the dressing changes, as opposed to doing it every 3 days like we're doing now. So I have a lot of ideas, but, you know, still having trouble putting them to work.
This is Grace. I'm just going to jump in and talk about one thing that we, in our discovery process and in looking at all of these issues, one of the things that we realized was that we throw a lot of terms around, and we have new residents that all come on board on July 1st, and they get sent into the patient room and told, you know, to go draw blood from a central line, and they kind of do the best that they can with their basic understanding of aseptic technique. So what we decided to put together, and this was sponsored by our nursing education department, but we put together a central lines skills lab, and we required all of our residents to attend it. It was a great success. It was a great bonding experience for doctors and nurses, and they were able to ask all their student questions. We made them do a return demonstration. Taught them how to access all the different lumens on a central line. We taught them the flushing protocol, syringe sizes, heparin flush doses, what a clave is, how to use a clave, how to draw blood, the specimen tube sequence. And actually, this is what I had been talking to Hillary about, because we got very positive feedback from all of the residents. That I guess there was an assumption that this was something that they knew when they got here on July 1st, and we learned that they don't necessarily know it. We teach it to our nurses, and we make sure that they're competent before they access a line or change a dressing, but it was not a core competency for our resident staff. So that was a great success for us. That made us feel really good that we were able to get out there and do that teaching with them.
Yeah, most of our line draws, when they draw blood from the lines in the unit, it's mostly in this. But when those patients get out on the floor with a central line, which is another no-no, but they do, residents are drawing blood from those lines.
And oh, I see. Okay, right. So that's a good example not only of the competency-based approach, which we know that several hospitals are starting to introduce, but also the issue that we were trying to introduce and our last couple of calls about the looking at the other parts of the hospital in terms of how they are contributing to or the problem and need to get on board with the solution. I think what we're going to do, instead of stopping at this point to do Q&A, let's do Mount Sinai, who's the other group we had teed up to talk briefly about some of their issues and approaches, and then we'll open it up to for the Q&A and folks can answer some of your questions about biopatch and some of the other issues that you raised. Lori?
Yeah, I'm actually here with Evelyn Nunez, nurse manager in the SICU, and Maxine Shepherd, nurse manager in the MICU, Dr. Calpe, our infection control officer, some of our infection control team and PI team. And I'm going to turn this over to Maxine for a little while to talk to us and to Evelyn about what our central venous line dressing change protocols are and the kind of validations we did of the staff in terms of the education. We can also respond to what we're doing with regard to changing that, the caps. And by the way, we're not using the biopatch.
On the central line venous dressing changes, our policy, what we did basically, we took it and we put it on a criterion checklist. We 1 to 18, very specific and straight to the point. Each nurse is validated on this, whether it's by myself or the educator or, you know, we work in combination to get all nurses on board one at a time. And we specifically have a dummy.
Mannequin.
A mannequin, yes. And we went as far as placing a catheter on the mannequin. The nurses did, and we put a Tegraderm on the mannequin. And then I go through the process of changing the dressing step by step with each nurse. Then what they have to do is I redress the area, and then they go through the criterion checklist, and it's either they get a met or not met. And if they didn't pass, we would have to do it over again until it's done correctly. Right now, 100% of our nurses are done. In addition to that, we went as far as we took pictures of the staff did and myself and everyone else involved in PI took pictures of one of the nurses in the bed pretending to be a patient. And again, she has a catheter that we cut and we did it so neatly that it looks like she actually has a triple lumen in her neck. And the other nurse goes through the step by step, the 18 steps that we picked out in our policy, and we made a book for each unit. It's a picture book, and underneath the pictures, it explains every procedure that is supposed to be done prior to the next page. It's great that the nurses loved it. They had fun making it. So they're really involved and participated in the prevention venous line dressing change kit. On that note, I'll turn it over to Evelyn, and we can also discuss.
Well, in addition to this, annually this will be part of our skills validation. This is one of our focus for the staff nurses. So we have at least three high volume, high risk procedures that we have to focus on, and we are focusing on catheter maintenance.
So, with regard to the question that came up about the cap change, the process that's been done here at Mount Sinai, which actually discussed at length in our weekly CLABS meeting,
when a nurse is going to access a catheter, the hub has to be cleaned with alcohol before doing that. And the caps are changed PRN when needed, when they have blood in them or when they look like they're contaminated. We don't change them on a routine basis of every 3 days because you actually open up the line for infection. And if you go in the CDC guidelines, it says PRN as needed. What we do try to do, however, is in our checkoff, when we do spot checks for nurses. We're going to start at this month in November, 10 nurses for QI purposes, is to see if they actually, if the caps get changed when a line is changed, or when the dressing is changed, and if that's being done. Basically, the nurse manager has to look around and see which line, IV line or IV tubing needs to be changed for that day. Because it's changed every 3 days, or you look at the dressing itself to see when it's due to be changed, and at that time we can actually observe the nurses changing the caps at that time. Again, the cap change is PRN. We don't encourage to open the line, and alcohol is used before and after. We do use a needleless system. We do not have a valve. We do take blood from the line, but not blood cultures. That's a totally different thing. And basically, that's it. Everyone is aboard. The entire team of nurses is on board. The doctors are on board with this. And it's working out for the for Mount Sinai at this moment. I hope it helps.
Thank you. That's great. And we'd just like to let folks know that we've now posted the 18 criterion checklist from Mount Sinai on the Jenny site.
Excuse me, Rachel?
Yes.
I have to say that we are 111 days infection-free. Thank you.
Yay.
Actually, Lori and the Mount Sinai team had given us the checklist during an earlier conference call, and we thought that form was great. It's in the best practices and information sharing portion of the Jenny website, and we're actually going to put more up there, too. Other hospitals have some great forms. I just spoke with someone from North Shore LIJ. They're going to be giving us a bunch of their forms for us to post, so we hope that you'll use those.
Hillary?
Yeah?
I want to tell you that we need to send you the most updated form.
Okay.
Because that actually addresses the cap change issue.
Okay, great. That will be great.
That's excellent. Thanks.
So I think now we'll open it up for some questions from the rest of the group and also certainly from others in the subconference. Operator?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you open it up for questions and comments?
If you may press a 1 key on your touch-tone telephone, if you have a question or comment, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone if you have a question or comment. And our first question comes from Mary McTighe from Trinidad's Hospital. You may ask your question.
Yeah, hi. Actually, this is Dr. Michael Brescia. I'm the medical director. Mary McTighe is in here, and I was late for the roll call. So I apologize for that.
Thank you for joining us.
I have a question about we were infection-free for about 5 months. We had one infection beginning of the 6th month, but we're, you know, cruising along. I think we're doing very, very well. A blip on our radar screen has been vascular surgeons insisting on putting Udall catheters in femoral veins because they're concerned about future access sites in the subclavian vein, if they're placed in the subclavian vein. I'm wondering if any other of the institutions have had this problem and how are they dealing with it. I actually have some literature in support of what they are saying. However, I also have some literature saying that the internal jugular vein is safe for a Udall insertion as far as preserving fistulas in the upper extremities. Can anybody comment on this?
It could be anyone. Dr. Cole, are you there?
I'm here.
I know that your hospital has done some work on, you know, standardizing the process for insertion. I don't know if you could.
We've really not had the issue that was just brought up.
Okay.
And my guess is that they're using IJs instead of the subclavians in that regard.
And they're not using them in the femorals at all.
I don't want to say at all, but all right. I would say that is the exception rather than the rule.
Okay. Okay.
The one place for us where it's tricky is our head and neck patients.
Right.
We have a really specialized service in terms of head and neck malignancies.
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
And they don't have a neck or even like a chest to speak of, unfortunately.
Right.
Really where we're seeing the femoral lines for the most part, and we don't have a choice.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question or comment comes from Audrey Adams from Montefiore Medical. Your line is open.
Yes, I just wanted to, can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
I just want to make a comment regarding the BioPatch. We have not gone to BioPatch either, and we've only basically had for the 4 months that we've been actively monitoring, we've had one central line bloodstream infection for the month of August and I believe one in September, zero for 2 months and one for 2 months each. And our physicians, though, you know, have been talking about the biopatch, and one of our directors felt that with the biopatch, you know, we are interested in looking at the biopatch would, I think, serve for the extraluminal infections that are around the lumen versus intraluminal infections. And so that's the comment I wanted to make. Someone had a question about the biopatch and the value of it. And I'm just wondering in terms of, you know, where we are seeing our infections coming from, extra or intraluminal. And I think here one of the things that we're going to be looking at closely has to do with the maintenance of our lines in terms of manipulation and how we are accessing the lines, which I think is a major issue. And I'm not quite sure if the biopatch would serve for that purpose.
Right, exactly. And
as
we know from all of our previous conversations, the use of the biopatch is not yet part of the bundle. It is not being used in a standardized way among hospitals. I think that one of the things that we will be trying to figure out as we continue through this collaborative is if we can actually discern the overall impact. But I think, Audrey, you're raising some really important points in terms of kind of the analysis that you need to apply from both a clinical perspective, and then obviously everybody is also looking at the financial issues associated with this as well. So unfortunately, I don't know that we have a single answer to that question at this point, but we hope that through the continued efforts through this collaborative, we will have some additional answers as we go forward.
Well, Dr. Shannon's experience was that he knocked down line infections from 37 to 6, and then when he went to the biopatches, he put it down to 2.
Right.
So he eliminated 4 infections a year with biopatches. So that tells you that how much of it is from the venipuncture site, you know, the puncture site, the wound site, as opposed to the maintenance, touching the lines for blood draw or line.
Yeah, but the other thing, though, was that they were only using it if the line was in for 3 days or more.
I think it was 7.
Or whatever. In other words, they weren't using it. You know, some people are using it for every single insertion and changing it every day. So that's why I'm just saying that the actual use of it has not yet been standardized.
Right.
But, again, we'll continue to share all those stories and examples as we go along. Just try to keep a little bit of an eye on time here. I don't want to cut off a good conversation, but – Operator, do we have anybody else in the queue for Q&A?
No, we currently show no other questions or comments.
Great. Okay, so let's, if folks don't mind, let's move on to, because we have 4 more topics, and we're going to have to go through this a little bit more quickly. 4 more topics that we were going to cover as part of this discussion today.
The next topic is something that's been discussed as difficult for some hospitals, implementing the central line bundle beyond the ICU, particularly the OR, is an area that some hospitals really want to do this, but they're having some difficulties doing it. I did talk to, again, someone from North Shore LIJ. That they said that they've started to do it there. And then also, I'm not sure, is New York downtown on the subconference yet, operator? Sonia Brown?
Pardon me, hold on momentarily while I check.
Okay. In the meantime, while we're looking for Sonia, Brian Cole from Beth Israel Medical Center said that he would talk a little bit about how they've started to implement the bundle in the ED, which is another area where we'd like to expand this. Dr. Cole?
Hi. We're actually not even going to tackle the OR here at this point in time, and probably not for the foreseeable future, because that's not where we've noticed lapses in practices.
Mm-hmm.
So the 2 places that we targeted were interventional radiology, where we have our PICC lines placed, and the ED. And in terms of sort of bringing them in, we included the emergency department from the very beginning. And all along, they kept on saying, why are we here, why are we here, why are we here? The efforts were with the critical care unit. And once we started getting successful data from our critical care units in terms of eliminating these infections, we went down to the ED. We showed them how successful this was. And right now, our policy is that if somebody has a line placed in the ED, it has to get changed within 24 hours. And we didn't feel that this was really fair in terms of risk to the patient in terms of them having to get stuck again. So basically, we observe practices, and we created a subgroup in the ED, much as we did with the critical care units, where they identified where their lapses and practices are, where their barriers to success are, and we had them devise a program. It was very interesting. It was very similar to what ultimately came out of the ICU, in that there's now an educational program for the residents. They're getting their central line kits, their central line carts, policy procedure. The ED nurses, believe it or not, are going to be monitoring the residents when they put in a line to make sure that they adhere to the bundle. And I would say this has taken probably about 2 months' time to get all this done. And that's where we are with them right now. People who were on our initial team were we had the nurse manager, we had the chairman, actually, of emergency services, the residency director, and we had some residents on the committee, and we just involved them from the beginning. And I think now that they're involved, you know, they're pretty excited about it because they now feel part of a bigger initiative.
And are you starting to see results yet, Brian, in terms of an improvement in their adherence to the bundle?
We haven't started measuring it yet.
Okay.
We're probably going to start we'll start measuring yesterday. It was November 1st, so we're going to start measuring the ED. But there really is no reason to expect that they won't adhere because really elsewhere in the institution, adherence is 100%. And the key for us for that is just to give the nursing staff authority to really whip the residents into shape. And the residents know now that they have to really listen to the nurses. So my guess is it should not be a problem.
That's great. Operator, did you find Sonia Brown or someone from New York downtown?
Pardon me, did not see that facility on board.
What was that?
I did not see that facility on board yet.
Well, you know, we'll open it up to the group now for additional comments on implementing the central line bundle beyond the ICU. And I know there are others out there that have started to implement this in the OR as well. And just one thing about that, we did send an email to some national experts that we know that have done this. We got a question yesterday from a hospital. They're looking for evidence to see if there's an impact on start time. So that's something that we've sent an email to find out if anyone knows anything out there. And if any of you on the call know anything, it would be great to hear your comments.
Yeah, right, or have otherwise dealt with her workflow issues in the OR relative to the bundle. If you could open it up then, operator, for Q&A.
Thank you. If you have a question or comment, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. And our next question comes from Diane Darnowski from Stanford Hospital.
Yes.
You may begin. Your line is open.
Thank you.
Diane.
Everything's always been very informative. I have a question for Brian Cole. The initiative was started in the ED, so am I to assume that when the patient goes on upstairs to your intensive care unit or to another area, you are not removing that central line then?
That will be the goal.
Fine.
Right now we're removing it, but the goal will be that if the practices are the same in the ED as they are in our critical care units, and we monitor those practices, we would expect the same results. The one, obviously, the caveat, if somebody comes in, you know, really septic shock where it's really an emergency situation, that's a little different than something that's more controlled.
Yes. All right. Thank you.
Great question. Thanks. Anybody else?
Our next question comes from Virginia Berdy from St. Catherine. You may ask your question.
Hi, it's Kathy Shannon from St. Catherine. I have two comments to make. We have brought our bundle elsewhere. The first place we brought it to was to interventional radiology, where we're putting in our PICCs, and we found them extremely compliant because it's being done under surgical, under sterile procedures, so we really didn't have too much of a concern there. But we also brought it to OR, and I don't know who made the comment before about how OR has no problems because they're doing under sterile technique. I really think they need to go and observe really what's happening within the OR. Because that's where we probably had our greatest amount of lines inserted secondary to interventional radiology. And we did have a problem related to anesthesia and the use of sterile technique and the use of our kit that we used and the use of the drapes. And they felt that they were in a sterile environment and therefore they did not need to use these things. So it was a big educational challenge to speak with anesthesia. And the next piece is where they're inserting, where anesthesia is credentialed to insert their lines is the internal jugular. So that's where we're having a problem because we're trying to get them to do a subclavian catheter rather than an internal jugular, and they're not credentialed for that. So our concerns are related to that. But we are coming along, and we've, done well within the OR as far as having anesthesia, getting to use the bundle, using the observational tool that we have, and coming along with what we want them to do. And it was a problem, but now it's coming along nicely. Oh, and the delay of time was mentioned. They did say that if they did insert the line in the OR, it would cause a half-hour delay for the surgical procedure, and what they tried to do was put it in PACU, which is a recovery room, so have the patient go to PACU first, put the line in, and then have them go to the OR. So a lot of our lines are being put in PACU first, but we haven't really seen the delay that they said that they would have if we did put them in there.
Thank you very much. Those are some great specifics, and we might hook you up with a couple other hospitals who've asked us some of those questions after the call is over.
Okay.
Thank you.
And Kathy, one more thing. I might be bugging you a little later to get that observation form to take a look at it.
Sure.
It sounds like a great tool.
No problem.
Do we have anybody else in the queue, operator?
Yes. Our next question comes from Sandra Hardy from NYU Medical. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Sandra Hardy. Just to let you know, we haven't done it in the OR, the ED, but we did do it in our transplant unit. The transplant team was very eager to get on board, and they have, because of their physicians, specific physicians, they have trained their physicians, and they have the nurses have obtained a cart, and the nurses have done their in services for the nursing personnel. We don't have any data as of yet because we just recently started this, but they were, you know, when they heard what we were doing in the ICU, they automatically said, you know, we have to do this down here. So that was very good for us.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. We show no further questions or comments in queue at this time.
That's terrific. Thanks, everybody. Let's move on.
Okay. Well, the next topic that we have on our agenda, and I'm not sure if the person's in the subconference as of yet, successfully implementing the daily goal sheets. Our Lady of Mercy was going to talk about how they've done that. Dr. Ronald Liss and Carmel, I always get Carmel's last name wrong, Bolin Reardon. Are either of you on the subconference?
Yes, Hillary, we're here.
Oh, great. Want to talk a little bit about what you've done at Our Lady of Mercy?
Yes. Our unit is a small unit. Prior to implementing the daily goal sheet, during the ICU rounds, all the observations that we have on the tool were routinely discussed, so it was easy to implement this. Development of the daily goal sheet, all the staff on the unit contributed, and we're on the fifth version right now, and that is as of October 3rd. This tool basically keeps the staff, nursing staff and residents, all the physicians, very well focused, and basically none of the fundamentals are missed. Compliance for the daily goal sheet, basically on days it's almost 100% compliance, but we're still having trouble with the night staff. So we're basically enjoying our success.
That's great. Dr. Liss, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think really we have very involved nursing staff, and they've really contributed to the whole process. And because of that, it's been pretty easy to implement the goal sheet.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very lucky to have the nursing staff that we have.
That's great. And actually, the night shift issue has been a problem for other hospitals as well. So unless you have a little more to say, I'll open it up again to see if anyone wants to give us their comments on how they've used the daily goal sheets. And again, the subconference participants can ask questions or give their input as well. So does anyone in the subconference have any additional comments to say about that?
Hillary, it's Lori.
Hi, Lori.
Sinai, hi. You know, we've had a lot of trepidation. We're using the daily goal sheet, and the physicians became somewhat disenchanted with it because they felt that really it wasn't, it was a piece of, an extra piece of paper that was being filled out that wasn't really being thoughtfully filled out, just because we were mandating that it had to be done. And so, you know, we're still, and there's not no evidence. I could say that that was, a lot of that was born out of the fact that we couldn't find any evidence in the literature that actually linked completion of the daily goal sheets with a central line actual reduction in infections. It was more related to improving communications and the culture in the ICU. And so we're trying to look at options, and unfortunately our ICU docs are not here right now, but options that would take the bundles that are listed, and you guys from the ICU, please correct me if I'm misspeaking, yeah, but correct the, you know, take the bundles that are listed in the daily goal sheet and somehow incorporate it into what's actually in the chart, in the notes, as well as developing something in our TDS system until we're completely electronic, in our TDS system that would be a trigger for those activities and that communication to take place and for a yes or no answer based on each of those. And so I think what we're trying to do is not eliminate the idea of incorporating the bundles, but looking at it in terms of incorporating it in a more thoughtful way for quality within our current work activities that isn't an extra piece of paper and then just thought of as an extra piece of paper. So, you know, to be continued. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of, we're making progress on that.
Yeah, and again, I think even with the simplest of changes, we can't ever underestimate the issues associated with workflow. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that we suggested to folks initially to try the small steps of change process to sort of test some of those things out, because sometimes it's all a bit too much to introduce all at once. So there's really nothing wrong with taking a more sort of incremental approach to get there.
Definitely, and I'll just go on that same point. Our Lady of Mercy, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, both of you, but they definitely took on that approach where they were using it, testing it out, and then making changes on their daily goal sheets based on the results that they saw from their small tests.
Yes.
Operator, can we just open it up and see if anyone else has any comments about daily goal sheets?
Yes, if you have a question or comment now, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. And our next question or comment comes from Donna Armelino from North Shore University. You may ask your question.
Well, I don't have a question. This is Donna Armelino. I work for the North Shore LIJ Health System. And we have some sites within the health system that are currently using the goal sheet. But some of the sites have been innovative. And what they've done with the goal sheets is created and made it part of the permanent record. So nurses and physicians will document on the goal sheet, permanent part of the record. Another site reworked the nursing documentation, and the entire bundles went in nursing documentation. So there is not an extra piece of paper that needs to be filled out as it relates to the CLABS.
Thanks, Donna. And also, Donna has gratefully given us their North Shore LIJ system daily goals forms, which we're shamelessly stealing and going to be including on the website. It's a great sheet, very short, concise, and I think it's something you all should look at when we post it.
Well, the forms that I'm making reference to, I will pull them from every site and send them so they can be posted.
Great.
And then also one of the sites, it's one of the community hospitals, did elect to revamp the physician ICU notes to also include the bundles. And when I'm making reference to the bundles, we elected as a system to implement the CLABS as well as the IHI VAP bundle at the same time. So, you know, the daily goal sheets as well as the documentation will include both the central line piece and also the event-associated pneumonia components.
Yeah, we have a couple other hospitals who are also taking that approach. Do we have anybody else in the queue, operator?
Yes. Our next question or comment comes from Patricia Henry from Long Island. You may ask your question or comment.
Hi. Actually, Donna just spoke for us, to be honest with you. I was just going to mention about our collaborative goal sheet. And it is, as Donna said, part of the permanent record. And while we're just launching it, we're very happy with it because we think that it really captures collaborative practice with the physicians and captures the essential elements of the bundle at the same time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question or comment is from Virginia Birdie's line from St. Catherine. The line is open.
Hi, it's Kathy Shannon again. I just wanted to comment that for the past 2 years, we've been using a goal sheet for VAP within the ICU and the CCU, so we took that sheet and then created our central line bundle tool and combined it with VAP. So we've also incorporated the VAP bundle, which we haven't been talking about here, in with this and decreased the amount of questions that we had on it previously, and it seems that the staff really like working with that better because we did not give them two pieces of paper. Now we've decreased it to one piece of paper. That's just my comment. Thanks.
Thank you. At this time, we show no further questions or comments in queue.
Thanks so much. And, Kathy, if you haven't already done so, please send that form to Hillary so we can include that in our best practice section of the website.
Yeah, we're really trying to beef that up, so all these are great ideas.
And we know there are several other hospitals, as I said, who are doing central line and VAP, but they may not have done daily goal sheets for both or either. So, again, we're trying to keep pushing tools out to you guys based on your needs.
Okay, so we'll go on to the next topic. This is a great conversation. The next topic that's been expressed as one of interest is standardizing the process for insertion. And, again, we've asked Brian Cole from Beth Israel to just give a brief overview of what they've done there.
Hi. This actually was handled through our critical care committee. We got representatives from all the units together. We took the CDC's recommendations. And we sat in a room for about an hour over 3 weeks' time, had everyone hammer it out, and basically came out with a policy that everyone can live with.
Sounds so easy the way you put that. What kinds of things are incorporated in the policy?
Basically, from soup to nuts, it's in terms of, number one, preparation of the patient, so the site, ensuring that everybody used chlorhexidine in an appropriate manner. Number two, defining what maximal barrier precautions actually means, because everyone had their own definition of what that meant. Also defining what we mean by draping the patient in an appropriate manner, because again, everyone had different practices regarding that. The major bone of contention had to do with the choice of the site,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of people really fought us a little bit in terms of using the subclavian site, mostly because they're concerned about risks of pneumothoraces. And most of the house staff here were actually not credentialed. So that really spoke to doing a very big educational component in terms of getting the house staff credentialed quickly. The other thing was also that we decided was that when a line is put in, that there had to be two operators versus just having one operator. And the reason for the second operator would be that really almost as an assistant, or if, God forbid, something goes wrong and you really need a person to jump in relatively quickly. And, you know, I mean, I think that's pretty much it. The other part, so that's for insertion. And then the remaining part, we didn't have to modify that much in terms of dressings, the cap changes, or so on and so forth. So that's, I think the reason it went easier was that we really made them design their own policy and procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it actually was, I would say, relatively painless. And then monitoring, I also was surprised that I think because they had designed the policy, everyone knew exactly what to do. And that also was relatively painless in terms of getting it into practice.
Great. We know a lot of you have actually focused on this issue, so I don't know if anybody has any comments or questions relative to standardizing the insertion process. If we could open it up for questions.
And again, the subconference is free to say anything.
Yes.
Thank you. If you have any questions or comments, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. Our first question or comment comes from Barry Gordon from North General Hospital. Your line is now open.
I'm sorry, but my comment was on the daily goal sheet.
Okay.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. It was a difficult process, but what we decided to do is to, rather than when the patient is admitted to the ICU, let's say the patient is admitted at night, we'll start the daily goal sheet on the following morning on the daily rank, where we have the respiratory therapist, the nurse, a nutritionist, and the doctor. So at least after the patient has been assessed, you know, we'll go through our checklist and decide what the plan of care is for the patient for that particular day. It's only done on a daily basis, so the night nurses and the day nurses are on one, everyone is on one page. So they know exactly what it is that we are trying to do for the particular patient. So it's only done once a day, so we don't have a problem with the night nurses or the residents on call following it up.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions?
Currently, we show no other questions or comments in the queue.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. And we are, last but not least, onto our last topic that's listed here. And we know there's many more, but we only had time to talk about five today. Obtaining physician buy-in. I do need to say I had a conversation with someone today which really struck me that they were talking to me. They said, you know, physician, it's great when the physicians get bought in, but as long as there's someone in the facility that's bought in, this could be a great project no matter what. So with that, I'm going to ask Dr. Barr, if he's there, if he could talk a little bit about how they obtained physician buy-in at Lenox Hill.
Hi, I'm here. Good afternoon. I'm also here with my stalwart team members. This is a collaborative. It's an evidence-based collaborative so that the first thing is to show everyone, both physicians, nurses, and other healthcare professionals, as Dr. Shannon did at the first presentation, how important this is both for morbidity and mortality and in this environment today, cost saving. Having said that, we were easily able to roll this out in the mixed medical surgical intensive care unit because it is a closed area. We're now going to roll this out into the cardiac OR, and that will have a spillover into the cardiac intensive care unit and a cardiac step-down unit. But that particular group of people is...
Dr. Barr?
Yeah.
Are you there? Sorry, we just lost you there for a sec.
I'm here. What I was saying is... What I was saying, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. What I was saying is that we're now going to roll this out to the OR cardiac surgery area, and this will also encompass then their cardiothoracic ICU and cardiac step-down area, and they are very infection control-oriented. So they there was no problem. They have come to us, really. And the same thing, the emergency department has now come to us as the critical care committee and the intensive care unit. From there, hopefully we will be able to roll this out to other areas of the hospital. But I think when this is presented in a very organized but concise way, showing these major tenants that everyone must and will buy into it. Do you have some commentary?
And we would just like to really acknowledge your very consistent participation and leadership in this effort throughout the collaborative. I think it's been very helpful. Thank you.
I would disagree and only say thank you, but I have such terrific support from all the other people that work here with me.
And we certainly know that, too.
It's a true team over there. So,
We understand that Sonia Brown has now joined us from New York downtown, and even though we passed on that topic, I think that issue of physician buy-in also comes up in terms of moving to the OR. Sonia, could you just give us a few comments about your experience of moving to the OR with this project?
Sure. Thank you, Hillary. What we tried to do was we tried to expand it, the CLAP project, outside of the ICU, initially just to the operating room and then to the emergency room and then to the units. To the patient care units. What we're hoping to do is sort of standardize across the board with using the same checklist that we use in the ICU and also to have it more accessible to them on the floors, especially with just a custom-made central line insertion kit that would contain the gown, the gloves, the drape, and the chlorhexidine, so it will make it a lot easier for them to be consistent. So far, we're just getting in the supplies, and we plan to do launch a big in-servicing campaign along with nursing grand rounds that's consistent with the project, and in hopes that we'll have it up and running before the end of the year.
Great. And Sonia, can you just describe the reaction so far of the anesthesiologists there?
Sure. When we first presented the project at our critical care meeting, they're actually part of the critical care committee, and they were very interested in being part as a participant. And I think that was sort of like our initial buy-in by having them be a member of the CLAB project. And we've ordered additional products just for anesthesia that are separate outside of a kit so that they could be in compliance with the CLAB project. So in terms of their experience and their expertise also, we've gotten greater buy-in from anesthesia in that sense.
Actually, one thing that I think we all heard through this is involving a lot of different disciplines and team members on the team and then them really getting involved in it. I think it sounds like that's really a constant theme here with all these topics. And we're going to open it up again for questions or comments about obtaining physician buy-in and if there's any questions or comments about implementing the OR based on what Sonia has told us. Operator? Patrick?
Thank you. If you have a question or comment, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. And we show no questions or comments in queue.
Thank you. Well, I guess that's because in covering these five topics and all these wonderful examples, questions solved all of your problems, and obviously we know that's not true. Otherwise, you wouldn't need us anymore. But we will come back to this format, I think, again in the future. It seemed like we got some good participation, interaction, and we know that that's one of the things that you all have been asking us to include in this program. Hillary, why don't you just quickly run through the updates, and then we can finish up here.
Sure. We only have about 10 minutes or so, I just wanted to let you know first, we had the October 19th learning session. You all knew that, and we put together the results from the evaluation form. We did get a lot of response. If any of you did attend the program and didn't fill out the evaluation form but want to, that would be great because, number one, we'd like your input, and, number two, there were the continuing education contact hours and CMEs involved with the program. So fill out that evaluation form, and we can give you the certificate for that. Pretty much the feedback was generally really good. We gave you a description of what we saw on the Likert scale questions, and then we gave you a two-pager on some of the open-ended comments that we got from you. I'm not going to go through all of it, but just some highlights. And, again, that's part of why we made this format. Some people said that there was not enough information about central line infections, and that maybe we should have incorporated some examples from the CLABS Collaborative into the program. As you do some of that today here in this call, and we will do more of that in the future. And then the other thing that we heard generally is that it was a good program. There should be more CEO participation and involvement and chief operating officer participation and involvement and nursing leadership involvement. So that's something we are following up. That's a good segue into a little discussion about our next conference calls that are coming up. First, the call on November 16th, speaking of senior leadership, we are trying to get some senior leaders on the call. We do have someone from Beth Israel Medical Center who will be on the call, the chief operating officer. Gail Donovan will be attending to talk a little bit about their senior leadership involvement in the collaborative and beyond the collaborative. And then December 21st, we have a senior fellow from IHI who will be attending the call. We spoke with him, Dr. Reinertsen, from IHI, as I said, and he did say to me that the call will be much more effective and will have more of an impact if all of you have your either CEO or chief operating officer on the line with you. So we're going to start to market that right now, that it would be beneficial if they were on that call. Moving back a little bit, the call for December 7th, that is going to be devoted more to the infection data results. While we have given you your infection data, we really haven't discussed the data on these calls, so Brian Taylor will be on that call to talk to you a little bit about the overall results and some of the baseline versus post-baseline data to date at that point. That's pretty much it. We just made a little note that IHI is having health day tomorrow, and we put the portion that's devoted to central line infections, which is tomorrow from 12 to 1, and the conference call number is included there. It is a free call, from what I understand.
And this is the national open house for the 100,000 Lives campaign.
Yes. And finally, I just want to talk a little bit about the survey, which we've gotten from some of you. By some, I mean six of you. We need a little more than that. One thing that the Lutheran team said that they wanted information with regard to the use of BioPatch that is incorporated on that survey, and we will be able to give that information. We just need more of you to fill out the survey. So I'm making one final plug for that, and I'll be sending it out yet again with a reminder to fill it out. The information will benefit all of you.
Maybe we need to do like an iPod giveaway or something like that.
Yeah, I'll,
that's good.
Funny.
Money. Very good.
Lunch, a gift certificate for lunch. But seriously, folks, we have emphasized to you at every turn that we can only make this program work for you if we continue to get your feedback. So please, the survey really should only take you a couple of minutes to fill out. If you could please do that and get it back to Hillary. The other thing is we've heard from many of you that you have incorporated many of these practices into your grand rounds, both physician and nursing. And we were talking yesterday about possibly seeing if we could get Dr. Shannon to come back and visit with a couple of hospitals to do grand rounds with you. So if anybody is interested in discussing that with us, just send an email to Hillary. And we will see what we can do to make those arrangements. We have completed our scheduled agenda at this point. And, operator, if we could just open it up one more time to see if we have any other comments or questions.
Thank you. If you have a question or comment at this time, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone. We show no questions or comments at this time.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. Hope you found this a good discussion. Feel free to send Hillary individual comments if you would like. Our next on November 16th. Thank you, operator.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may all disconnect.